Jay Griffiths first wanted to be a writer, an entity she believed to be a godlike creature when she was just 4 years old and already captivated by words. And she's fulfilled that early ambition. Her books include Wild, the product of 7 years' work travelling to wildernesses, including the Amazon rainforest, the Canadian Arctic, and the Australian outback. She's also written very honestly about her experience of bipolar disorder in her book Tristomania, a diary of manic depression. More recently, she's reflected on the deep connections we have to animals and their ability to alleviate fear and trauma, under the title How Animals Heal Us. Well, Jay, you've brought a very popular mix of musical animals today, Sibelius, Rodrigo, Vivaldi, but I think we're going to start with Debussy.
Yes, Debussy's First Arabesque. I love this piece. I used to play it when I was younger. I learnt classical piano.
Well, it's performed here by Jean-Eflamme Bavouzet.
Thank you.
Debussy's Arabesque, number one in E major, performed by Jean-Éphelin Bavouze. Does that sound very different to the way you played it?
Oh, cruel question. It actually, it's rather a lot better than the way I played it, yes, I have to admit. But just listening to it again, because I've played it so many more times than I've heard it, that piece felt like, this is what my hands are for. When you play it, the piano rises to your hands. It's an exquisite piece to play. And the only other thing in my life that is really comparable to it is clay sculpture, because I studied clay sculpture at St. Martin's, and that feeling of kind of always keep the clay wet. And then the clay comes, it rises to your hands, and that feeling that you're making it, but as you're touching it, it is also making you. It's an exquisite piece to play, and I think there's such a relief of the reprise when it comes back as you play it, and it's almost like you just sigh with the relief, the pleasure, the consolation.
I'm interested that you mentioned wet clay, because I keep hearing water when I hear that piece. And, you know, if you just worked out the chords and plonked them down, it wouldn't be very interesting. But it's a tribute to arpeggios, really, isn't
it?
Rippling.
Isn't it? And also, when I was listening to it, I was thinking of my very beloved piano teacher who played me the Le Cathédrale Engloutie. And when she played it, I was absolutely captivated by that sense of, I didn't know that you could hear something submerged. I didn't know.
Well, that's the Sunken Cathedral.
Yes.
Another piece by Debussy in which he imagined what bells might sound like from a sunken cathedral.
Yes. And that thing of just what music can do is it can take you to places which are other parts of the world that you had no idea of.
Do you find that music has a kind of physical thing on your body? I mean, I can never keep still when I'm listening to moved by something, and I saw you gazing up into the ceiling during that, sort of transporting.
Transporting. That's exactly right. It's an elsewhere thing that music speaks to, that some people kind of speak of it as beyond language, beyond words. But I think it's also, it gives you access to emotions where you didn't necessarily know the specific nuance of an emotion, and then you hear it in a piece of music and there it is.
Tell us a little bit about your early life. You were born in Manchester but grew up outside London.
Yes.
Was nature important to you as a child?
It's always been important to me. I mean, in the sense, I think that for all children, the animated world was very quick to me. I mean, not that we lived in vast expanses of nature, but there was a garden, there was a park nearby, there were trees, and I was always up a tree. And I loved reading up trees. There was a particular tree in one of the parks that I realised that I could climb up into with a book, sit in one particular place, and nobody ever looked up.
So you nested there?
Yes.
Were your parents musical?
They were and they weren't. My father had a lot of musical interests, but my mother was a young child in the First World War in Bristol. And actually the house that she was in as a small child was bombed while she and her mother and brother and sister were in the cellars. And I think the terror of that left her really lifelong a lover of silence. So in some ways, the music in the house was brought in by my father's records, by me playing the piano, and by my brothers bringing in punk records when they were teenagers.
This next piece reminds you of your dad.
It does. Before he married my mother, he trained as an architect. And he went to Nigeria and he was there for some years and he was building a school and he had certain records. And this is one of them. His records when he came back from Nigeria were absolutely full of sand. And the only way that I could play them was by, it sounds terrible, was by pushing the needle right into the groove. So what I heard most strongly through all of his records was a very clear melody, but very little of the kind of the nuance around it. And this is one of his.
I think we can do a little bit better than that for Radio 3. Morning Mood from Peer Gynt by Grieg.
I think there's something in that which is so exquisite. And it's like a kind of Laurie Lee moment as I walked out one midsummer morning. Now that I'm no longer a child, I think that that must have been almost like my father's, like a fairy tale setting out. And Peer Gynt, of course, in the fairy tale set out from Norway to the deserts of North Africa. And we all have to set out and find our fortune. And I think also the beautiful sense of the sun rising and the moment where both you and I looked at each other and said, that's the moment where the sun actually rises.
And the way he builds up to it, yes. He sort of contracts and releases. It's yes. like a moment of delayed gratification.
Isn't yes. it? And then also all the creatures that wait for sunrise, that sing for sunrise, you know, the birds, obviously, but gibbons also sing for sunrise. And it is thought by some indigenous cultures that their singing makes the sunrise, which is such a beautiful idea.
We heard Morning Mood from Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite, performed by the Malmö Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Beata Engelstad. Your grandmother was also an important figure to you growing up.
Yes, she was. Well, actually both my grandmothers, but my mother's mother was immensely literary. I think she felt slightly constricted by the era in which she grew up and motherhood, but she gave me an enormous sense of confidence. And actually the very first book I wrote for her, but I was about six at the time, something like that. And it was a book obviously written by hand, sellotaped together, that I gave to her. And she took it in her hands and she looked at me so seriously and she said, I very much look forward to reading the first book that you get published. And sometimes what adults can do for small children is to give them an enormous sense of acknowledgement, of recognition and belief. I see you. In one sentence, she saw me.
And when did you get your first, let's call it, Call of the Wild?
Well, when I was 16, I went to a youth club. And two of the youth club leaders, unbeknownst to us, really fancied each other. They needed a way to kind of spend some time together. I see this with hindsight. Anyway, they asked four of us to Snowdonia. It was the most magical invitation. So I said yes. And it was between Christmas and New Year. We were camping. There was snow up to our thighs. We went climbing, rock climbing. We went walking in whiteouts. And to me, it was the most utter exhilaration. It was like touching the real thing. It was so important to me.
So you've got that sort of travel bug that certainly Laurie Lee had.
Mm.
The Allegri Miserere next. This is a very popular piece, and of course it rises to the stratosphere at one point. Why do you love it?
I love this because it reaches a kind of sense of divinity that I think whatever you believe, and I don't have a formal religious faith, but I really have a sense of divinity in the living world and in music. And he touches it. And I think also this music, it's almost like Vaughan Williams' Lark Ascending. It takes us higher and higher and higher into a sense of heaven's quintessence. It's pinpointing God as it rises.
Thank you.
Allegri Miserere, performed by the Choir of King's College Cambridge, directed by Stephen Clebury. J. Griffiths, one of your first books was called Pip Pip, A Sideways Look at Time. And you were looking at how different cultures perceive time. What was the most surprising thing that you discovered?
Oh, goodness. I think one of them was if you stop considering time as linear, with the past behind you and the future ahead of you, but you consider the past as being something which is in the earth under your feet. And I was really struck by that. That's something that Indigenous Australians will often say. It's like, you know, and it makes sense. It's like
song lines.
The song lines, but also the kind of place of burial, the archaeological past is under our feet. And it was quite transformative.
One of the really interesting things you explored is how women's time is different from men's.
Yes. What I was looking at in the book as a whole was how time is a political subject, and people had looked at it in the sense of speed is political, progress is political. But I wanted to say, look, it's political in terms of empire, that we didn't just create empires of land, we also created empires of time, imposing a kind of Protestant British sense of time and time values, and that it was also political in the sense of gender, that the typical idea of linear time was highly masculine and women's experience of time is far more cyclical.
And did you find that time tends to slow down, speed up in different places?
Yes. That's the thing, because we all know that sense of our own mind's relationship to time and our spirits and our body's relationship to time is that it's different what we can do at 8 in the morning and what we want to do at 8 in the evening. But I think also that if you put that in the context of chirological time and chronological time, you know, two of the Greek gods of time, Chronos, much more sort of mean-spirited, mathematical. Kairos is the spirit of the moment. Is this chirologically the right time for the individual, for a group of people? When a group of people suddenly falls silent, it's angel passing over, it's mercurial. It's the spirit of Kairos as a nuanced, subtle idea of what kind of time we are in.
I find, I don't know if you would agree with this, that the difference in time when we're in, for example, London, and I spend quite a lot of time in mid Wales, is immense.
Well, I've been living in mid Wales for 25 years, so yes, I do understand that. If the world around you is so deeply living and natural, you can't help but be imbued by a sense of its slowness, but also its profundity.
The Concierto de Aranjuez, the famous Rodrigo guitar concerto, is this something you've always loved?
I've loved it since I heard it. Mm. And the thing that I would compare it to in writing is Lorca's essay El Duende, 1933. He was assassinated in 1936. Rodrigo's concerto written in 1939. I'm not saying that Rodrigo had the same politics as Lorca, but those two, that essay, Lorca's El Duende, which is really looking at what fires art, the arts, and Rodrigo's concerto, they have a sense of the utter passion of the earth, something that surges up from the earth into you, almost through your feet. It's a transformative charge, as it were, and there's an electricity to it. And when I was writing about animals, one of the things that delighted me is how they are transformers. They have transformed me. When we see animals, a specific part of the brain lights up in a flare of electrical activity. When we see a mouse, an elephant, a whale, a dog, a frying pan, something lights up for all of them, but not the frying pan. And it's in the right amygdala, right in the heart of us, something lights up. And that charge is in this piece, but it's a form of passion where we also see the etymology of passion, which is to suffer. And I think the Adagio section of this is almost fatally sad.
And that Spanish duende is what led to flamenco.
Yes, exactly. The fire, it's the elements that create flamenco literature and poetry.
Thank you.
There was a particular reason why you homed in on the Allegro, apart from the fact that you like it, wasn't there?
Well, yes, it's because had we had the Adagio, I would have been in tears.
So we had the Allegro con spirito from the Concierto de Aranjuez for guitar and orchestra by Rodrigo, and it was performed by the guitarist Xu Efe Yang and the Barcelona Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Eiji Oue. J. Griffiths, your next book, Wild, An Elemental Journey, was a seven-year odyssey to many different wild places. So you had to decide where to go, and how did you?
Oh, that's a really good question. I wanted to visit places which would give, within a book, a sort of potted world. So I wanted to visit a place which would be an exemplar of an earth wilderness, a water wilderness, an ice wilderness, a fire wilderness, which was the desert, and an air wilderness, which was the West Papuan Highlands. But I wanted that sense of the immense knowledge that is held in indigenous cultures about the world, of how, you know, the Amazon forest is not just a place full of trees and animals and plants. It's a university. It's where people have understood medicine for thousands of years. There's a richness to it that we wouldn't dream of losing, a cultural richness. You know, it would be like, you know, napalming the Berlin Philharmonic and destroying every copy of the Oxford English Dictionary. That is what we do when the Amazon is destroyed. And I wanted to listen to those who are the knowers of the knowledge of the Amazon to see what they said about what is wild.
And you met a man who remembered missionaries.
Yes, it was a man called Tarzan, although he'd never seen a Tarzan film in his life. And he said when missionaries first came to our lands, they gave us the Bible and Spanish and the idea of work and money and schools. But he said we didn't need the schools because after the missionaries had come, our children died. This absolutely grievous sense of having known his culture be truncated in front of his eyes in the most bewildering, confusing way.
And by contrast, in the Arctic, how did you experience extreme cold?
Well, for one thing, I really dislike being cold. But at the same time, I want to know what it's like to be the animal that I am, the animal that we all are. So there was one moment where I thought, I need to go off somewhere out of the community alone. And I want to take my clothes off. I want to feel what this is like. And I have never realized quite so viscerally, quite so powerfully, how much of an animal we are, because I suddenly knew myself to be completely prey. I was prey to the ice, prey to the temperature, prey to the ignorance that I had of that land, and prey, of course, to polar bears. I have never put my clothes on so fast.
You also spent time with shamans, didn't you?
Yes, in the Peruvian Amazon. That was an immensely important, probably the most significant part of my whole life, actually. They were ayahuasqueros, which is that they drink ayahuasca. It's a medicine. This is not a recreational drug. It's a very, very serious medicine with an enormous cultural hinterland behind it. And they take it very seriously. They say before you drink it, you must adopt a diet, which is very strict. So I did that and I went, and it was an extraordinary experience. There's a power within that medicine that gave me a sense of an alignment with the real and living world, where I felt that I mattered, but mattered no more than a monkey or a piece of liana or something. And so it was both humbling and strengthening.
Is it plant-based?
Yes, it's entirely plant-based, and it's sung. When I say that, this is not a trivial thing. Ayahuasqueros have Icaros, which is like the music of the forests, a fluted melody. You can almost see the melody when they smoke. It's kind of a sacred use of tobacco. When the smoke comes out, you can see the melody in the smoke as they breathe it out. And it's half sung, half whistled. It's half heard, half known, half unknown. It's utterly exquisite, like nothing else. I have got a cassette of it, but it's not something which I feel can be played too lightly. But the other way that I've heard the sounds of the forest is in the Babanzeli music that the musicologist Louis Sarno heard once, got a one-way ticket to the central rainforests, including the Congo, where the Babenzeli people live. And like for the shamans in the Amazon, this is where the human voice and the voices of the forest entirely meld, a sound world where our human voices are intrinsic, that we are not a blot on the landscape. We humans are an intrinsic part of the living world. And to me, it's like drinking in the vitality of the forests, listening to this, the insects, the sloths who sing at night in the intervals of a human musical scale, this exquisite world which, when we are full of the sound of this, makes us sound well, full. And it's like life's deepest prayer, let there be life.
That greeting from the Babenzeli people was recorded by Louis Sarno, and it's from the album Song for the Forest. Certainly evocative of a different culture, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think it's one of those ways in which the more we listen in a sense of plurality, the more we can have a sense that the dominant culture, the one that almost all of us live in, is not the only one.
Your affinity for the environment has meant you've written about and stood up for nature. You wrote a book called Why Rebel, a kind of poetic manifesto. Did you feel that was necessary to say then?
I think there's been so much of a sense that the natural world and those who speak for the natural world are doing it because it's their hobby. They are environmentalists, so of course they're going to talk about the environment. And one of the things that I wanted to say over and over again is nature is not a hobby. It is the life on which we all depend. A hobby is, I go mountain biking, that's a hobby. I go climbing, mountain climbing, that's a hobby. But actually, the water, the climate, the air, the oceans and the insects, everything that we need depends ultimately on the living world, and so much so on the insects.
Bees in particular.
Bees in particular. E.O. Wilson, a famous entomologist, points out we humans would survive such a short amount of time, months probably, without the insects. And we're killing the insects on which we depend. Insecticides should be made illegal overnight.
In Why Rebel, you talked about the importance of a politics of kindness.
Yes. One of the things that our human politics has led us too much towards is a politics which is confrontational, reliant on lies. And there's an aspect of the populist climate which is so power-based. And actually, my feeling is that most humans are kind, and we don't want unkindness towards other people or towards the living world. When I've been thinking and writing about bees, for example, I would say that, you know, they are the epitome of kindness. It would take approximately a bee's whole life for a teaspoon of honey. They also give the world the kindest form of politics, this kind of collective decision-making, honeybee democracy. They listen to experts. They always accept dissent, unlike some governments, and they rely on the importance of dancing their information. But also the hum of bees stimulates the cerebrospinal fluid in the brain, which is really good for the immune system. Ancient Egyptians said that the bees humming releases the elixirs of metamorphosis.
You took part in Extinction Rebellion protests. In fact, you were arrested in April 2019. I wonder what it felt like to go through that court process.
I did get arrested. I've never been arrested before. I had no criminal record. I actually felt it was immensely important at that point to say, yes, I will put my hand up for a philosophy of mass arrests. I don't think that everything that Extinction Rebellion did after that was always wise, but that spring of 2019, it felt like the media was listening, the police were listening. The support that we had from the police was immense, and the media, and politicians, and the public. And I did feel it was important to say, yes, I will stand with this. In court, I had spoken to the judge in a way that left him in tears, actually. And he saluted our courage and our honesty. And his words when he finished his summing up was, you have to succeed.
What would you say to people listening who feel that protests can disrupt the daily life of working people without achieving a tangible change?
Yes, I'm very sympathetic to that. It's such a difficult thing because the necessity of what has to be said publicly about the insects, the oceans, the bees, the climate, is not being said widely, deeply, personally, passionately enough in the media. That's what drives people to need to protest.
The Secret Songs of Ponds next. That's a fascinating title.
This was music that I heard in lockdown. David Rothenberg, the wonderful jazz clarinetist, philosopher, musician, writer. He's played with whales, he's played with birds. And in lockdown, he decided he would listen to the music of insects underwater in ponds, created a hydrophone. And a few weeks ago, he was visiting me in Mid Wales and brought one of the hydrophones for me. So I have the kit now to drop it in any lake or any pond and listen for myself. When I heard the music that he was making in lockdown, I was absolutely thrilled by it. It was both serene and thrilling. I felt that I was an instrument that the insects were playing, and I heard it right inside me. And it's one of the things that I loved about it is that in this era where, you know, various billionaires think that it's interesting and important to find life on Mars, to me it's like this is deranged and fatuous. We need the imagination for this world, including the insects in the ponds. One of the things that we can hear in that is not just the insects, but it's the sound of plants photosynthesizing. It's extraordinary. The kind of little regular releases of sound. This is like listening to life itself.
The Cape Cod Long Pond, recorded by David Rothenberg on his album Secret Songs of Ponds. Jay Griffiths, you spent time investigating childhood or the childscape. Why was that important to you?
One of the things when I was writing Wild, An Elemental Journey, is that I was so conscious that in one Indigenous community after another, I didn't hear the sound of angry, cross, sulky children crying. And many, many anthropologists have commented on this, and I thought it would be so interesting to look at childhood, not as a parenting book. This is not a parenting book. But to look at it from the point of view of children and their need for the living world, the wild.
Interestingly, indigenous cultures treat children differently, but in a way that appears to be beneficial.
Yes, I think an enormously important part of this is will. In our culture, in the dominant culture, there's been this idea, since Methodism really, that the will of the child must be broken, so controlled. There's a very common philosophy in indigenous cultures, from the Arctic to the Amazon, that the will of a child needs to be respected. And the point is this: it is not that the child then is encouraged to become a selfish little brat. By having their will respected, they also learn to respect the will of others. That is the second part of the trick. And that is a way in which people grow up to feel respected and acknowledged and honoured in what they need and want, but also to offer it back.
In your most recent book, How Animals Heal Us, you talk about how important pets are to children. A boy who spent some time with donkeys, for example, and his behaviour completely changed.
Yes, a boy who had anger issues, difficulty making friends, and he was asked by an equine therapist to spend some time with donkeys. And at first, he would run after them. His movements were really jerky and speedy. He was trying to impose his will, as it were, on theirs. And the therapist asked him, I imagine quite kindly, how did he think the donkeys felt about him? And he said he didn't think they liked him very much. They ran away. And she was saying, well, perhaps you could approach them more gently. Let them come to you. Don't chase them. And after that, he started adopting those behaviours with donkeys. And then he could see how that also applied to people.
That's very fascinating. We're going to hear Mozart next.
Yes, the jubilation of the magic flute, the zest, the vitality, this beautiful trickster Papageno. You know, he's a birdcatcher. He's half man and half bird. This is like a song of utter delight. Und ich ihr Mann.
The famous Papageno aria from Act One of The Magic Lute by Mozart, sung by the baritone Olaf Baer, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, was conducted by Neville Marriner. Jay Griffiths, you've had your own mental health struggles and written about it very openly. You had one episode that lasted a year that you described with the 18th century word, actually it sounds like Angela Carter, to tristomania. Why did you use that word?
Oh, because it's a word which has a real depth and a sense of significance. Bipolar sounds so mathematical and cold, and actually tristomania has got the sort of tristesse of sadness in French. It's got the sense of distress. And mania is the right word, I think, for a sort of sense of what floods through you. Yes, that was an extremely difficult year, but also quite an enlightening one.
The psychiatrist Anthony Storr on this programme, I talked to him about people with severe manic depression. And we were talking about music, of course, because it was private passions. He said, actually, when people are in the middle of that, they can't listen to anything.
What I found was that I couldn't listen to anything, I couldn't read anything, I couldn't write anything, except what I made myself do was scribble notes on anything I could find to sort of tether myself. I didn't think that I was doing it because I would write about it. Although, you know, the kind of great thing for writers is the worse it is at the time, the better it is in the book. But it's also that people are often able to write about depression but not able to write about mania. And what I felt was, I want to capture this. I want to be able to give a more accurate sense than I felt is widely given, that this is not as simple as depression is feeling sad and low, mania is feeling happy and high. This is not happiness. And it's also, strangely, not unhappiness. To me, it's a matter of disconnection in depression and overconnection in mania. Everything overconnects in mania. Everything, every word. You know, this is why Spike Milligan was kind of such a punning person, and Coleridge too, would just, his mind would skip from one thought to another so quickly people couldn't catch up. There's also a sort of sense of spending and speed, but a connection between people, which is why quite often in manic states, people have very unwise liaisons. Depression, which people think of as a sadness, of course it is, but it's much, much more disconnection, which is so painful. And also how the trickster runs through it all. The trickster figure, which is so much the messenger god, very much the god of writers, which is why a lot of writers and artists are, you know, bipolar, manic depressive. And so I was looking at that way that the speed, the message, the energy of it all was very culturally connected.
That leads me to an interesting question, I think. If you could get rid of that part of yourself, would you?
No. And I think that's probably what a lot of us would say. I think that what I do feel, though, is I wish that I had learnt to manage it when I was much, much, much younger. I wish I had felt that I mattered enough for it to be diagnosed, to be understood. I feel now that I do manage it pretty well, which is kind of some really boring things like really good food, really good sleep, really good exercise, plenty of it. And also to notice in advance if I am moving into a depressed place, and I'll take pills.
Mm. Have animals been important during these moments?
Well, I think you know the answer. Animals have been an absolute salvation to me. The pandemic was very hard for me. You know, I was living alone and my father had just died, and I had my cat Otter, because he arrived on the day of the otter, according to the French Revolutionary calendar. And he was my company. He was the hearth, really. But then I started thinking, but it's not just pets. It's the animals that surround us all the time. It's the mindedness. It's the singing of the birds, which are good for mental well-being for up to 8 hours. It's the fact that we are surrounded by other minds, not just human minds, by minds that dream. So, for example, baby jumping spiders dream. Get that. We know that because when they're babies, their pigmentation hasn't come in. We see their eyes move into rapid eye movement. Their little legs are kind of clutching and twitching in and out and in and out, and they're spinning. We're surrounded by the dreaming of animals. We're surrounded by the senses of animals. We're surrounded by their healing nature and the sounds they make. A cat's purr is physically really good for us. Their company is incredibly important. Families who have a pet tend to argue less than families who don't. You know, cortisol goes down and oxytocin goes up. We want this. But also socially, they're really healing. Anthropologists are now saying we got our ethics from the wolves because we were nasty, rude, scruffy little people. And it's said that early humans started watching wolf societies and going, okay, look after the young, offer food to the old who are too old to hunt for themselves, act as a good individual but also a good pack member. Crucially, use the gift of friendship. And friendship is, in fact, what I think our next track is for me really stands for.
So it's Finlandia that you've chosen by Sibelius.
This is a private passion. This is an anthem to friendship. A very dear friend of mine, Marg Munyard, she played it to me several times, and friendship has been one of the most important things in my whole life. The word friend is related to the word free. It's like a freely chosen thing, the wide horizons, the loyalty, the love.
dynamic music, isn't it?
Yes.
Finlandia by Jean Sibelius, performed by the Chinake Orchestra, conducted by Kevin John Edusay. Jay, during lockdown, you wrote about many journeys in Nemesis, My Friend. Why that title? Has it all been a nemesis?
Well, it's because Nemesis is considered as this vindictive kind of, you know, goddess of punishment. Actually, what she does is she just says there are limits. And actually, we really, really need that in this age at the moment. She is our friend. We can't treat the climate as we are physically and not expect the consequences that are coming. We need to know those constraints.
Your next track, I think, reminds you of the desert.
This is a track that I absolutely adore. It's from Tanarawen, and they are from the Tuareg people of Mali and the Sahara. The words of this track include, you know, I'm a traveller in the lone desert. Those who walk together find a path empty of meaning. But the thing I like the most about this is the rhythm, the undulation of a camel walking. It's beautiful. This is not a nomadic culture, but our minds are always nomadic and should be, is to go on a quest, to go on a journey, to be constantly questioning things and looking for things and exploring.
Masakul in Tenere, composed by Ibrahim Agala Habib and performed by Tinari Wen. I was fascinated in how animals heal us, Jay Griffiths, by the ways in which animals can help diagnose as well as treat diseases.
Animals can be utterly astonishing. There are dogs who have detected cancers. Quite often this was untrained dogs. Dogs are also being trained by the charity Medical Detection Dogs to do this. Dogs can also give their humans what's called a tell or an alert, when they are about to experience a diabetic incident or postural tachycardia syndrome and forms of epilepsy.
And they do respond, animals, to the respect you give them. We had a very difficult bull on the farm, and he'd just been turned upside down to have his hooves looked at. So he wasn't a very happy bunny, well, bull. But I started singing to him.
Oh!
And then he came up to me and started nuzzling.
Oh, what a beautiful story.
Given that he was just over half a ton, I'm glad to say there was a barrier between us, but he did come and nuzzle, and it's amazing how music can get through to animals as well as humans.
Absolutely. I think we underestimate animals all the time. I think we underestimate what they model to us and who they are.
Yes, well, let's have some final music now. What have you chosen to end on?
Well, I've actually chosen one of Vivaldi's recorder concertos, and this is because, like most people, I find the admin pile can get a bit overwhelming. And I love writing. I don't always love the admin pile. So sometimes, occasionally, when it's all a bit too much, I encourage to step forward one of my sub-personalities, who I call Sincerely, Sally. And Sincerely Sally is ready in 3 minutes. She wears one of my dresses that I don't wear, one of my jackets that I don't wear. She also wears red lipstick that I almost never wear. She's friendly, she's cheerful, she's efficient. She gets a little cup of coffee and she puts this music on and she's off. She clears the admin pile.
Jay Griffiths, thank you very much.
Thank you.